Not a lot, but it's a lot if you don't know what you're doing. Now, and I love the equipment in here, and I just thank our Miyuki and all of everyone else for doing what you do and making WPFW a better place. A better place.
Hello, I'm David Whetstone, and you're listening to member-supported WPFW Washington.
It's Christmas in Mansfield, Ohio. The children are snuggled in bed, but there are no visions of sugar plums dancing. It's questions that fill up their heads.
There was a sense of hopelessness when I walked in that night, and when they found out.
Greetings y bienvenidos a todo mi gente escuchando en Washington and all points beyond. This is Oscar Fernandez, and you're listening to the Latino Media Collective Best of 2024 Year in Review Part 2. And in Part 2, we take a look back on some of the issues covered by highlighting some of the most important topics covered by our best guest. And since we covered so much this year, we're actually doing a three-part episode on the year that was. The last episode highlighted some of the most important international stories covered on the show. Part 2 highlights the most important domestic issues covered on the show this year. So for example, since 2024 was an election year, immigration once again became a convenient punching bag for Republicans during the course of the year. The right-wing narrative has been so strong that even Democrats began to parrot the narrative like never before. So in early March, we spoke with Heidi Byrick, the co-founder of the Global Project Against Hate and Extremism, about how such anti-immigrant sentiment has led to an increase of armed groups along the U.S.-Mexico border. So needless to say, there's been a lot to discuss in 2024 in and of itself. So I'm going to do my best here to present a timeline of events, you know, beginning this past February. So for example, on February 1st, your organization, along with several Democratic lawmakers and others, held a press conference warning people about the growing anti-immigrant extremism along the U.S.-Mexico border. Around the same week, an incident in Eagle Pass, which I mentioned at the beginning, forced a migrant center to be evacuated by threats from anti-immigrant groups. Later in the month, both President Joe Biden and former President Donald Trump held separate publicity visits to the U.S.-Mexico border amid the state's increasing or escalating militarization by Texas Governor Greg Abbott. And speaking of Abbott, this month the Supreme Court ordered Texas to allow federal border agents access to the state's border with Mexico, where Texas officials have deployed miles of concertina wire. There's a lot to process here this month, but Devin Burkhart, who is president of the Institute for Research and Education on Human Rights, and it was also in that same press conference that I mentioned, in my opinion, sort of crystallized recent events by saying that, quote, the standoff between Texas and the federal government has become a magnet for far-right vigilantism. So I want to ask you two questions here. One, if you can expand sort of on Devin's theory here, as well as other key points in this press conference that also deserves our attention.
Yeah, well, let me start with Devin's comments about far-right extremists in the border. There is no question that Governor Abbott's standoff with the Supreme Court and with the federal government over immigration, and his rhetoric, in particular his rhetoric that immigrants are, quote-unquote, invading the United States, has activated far-right extremists across the board. So, for example, my organization found Proud Boys chapters in Texas saying things like, get your guns, go to the border, right? Just some of the most extreme elements in our society, these white supremacist groups who have really latched onto this idea and are focusing their support on Governor Abbott and their anger on immigrants. And you mentioned the migrant center that had to be evacuated because the FBI found all these horrible threats online. Just around that same time in February, there was also an arrest of some militia members who were planning to go to the border and shoot both migrants and Border Patrol agents, government officials. They were found with all kinds of guns in their cars. And this is just an example of what happens when you demonize migrants with the kind of language that Abbott and others have been using, because you make people feel like they're, hey, there's an invasion going on. We should be able to shoot back. This is why this is so particularly scary overall. The other thing is, of course, Eagle Pass became the site of this convoy of people who considered themselves representatives of God, I think they said, a convoy made up of conspiracy theorists, far-right extremists, Christian nationalists, a whole gamut of far-right figures who went down to Eagle Pass and inserted themselves into this situation. And it's clearly not what folks who are living in the border area want to have happen. Eagle Pass business leaders, faith leaders, and others were very clear about that. And it just adds to the whole danger of what's going on down at the border. And if Abbott keeps up this rhetoric, which is, of course, quite rife on the far right among people like himself, other governors, other elected officials, it puts immigrants in danger every single day.
So the issue of religion is going to come back during the course of this conversation as far as religious fanaticism, as far as I'm concerned. But you sort of answered my question with the issue of Eagle Pass. The Washington Post actually did a good article with regards to Eagle Pass that also included detailed maps and satellite images of what we're talking about here and what this militarization actually looks like. So, for example, it's kind of interesting that one of the main bridges from Mexico to the U.S. has this golf course underneath it, which is kind of sort of an odd and perverse example of wealth inequality in and of itself right there. But be that as it may, in the same town, it's also one of the busiest railroad crossings from Mexico to the United States. And many migrants who don't have the means to do so have used freight trains to travel this at the risk of serious injury or even death. And in addition to that, Eagle Pass is not that far from another problematic area, which is Del Rio, Texas. And in that Washington Post article, I thought to myself, Del Rio sounds very familiar. And then I remember that, oh yeah, in 2021, this was the same place where Border Patrol agents on horseback were using whips on Haitian migrants. You know, it's been almost 3 years, but this is where those infamous images came from, which also gives another example of sort of the xenophobia and anti-immigrant sentiment that you mentioned and that your organization, you know, mentions as well, and also how militarized the border is as well. So I want to ask you both with regards to the threats by militias, which you sort of answered already, but also about Governor Abbott's proposal to create a military base there, because it seems like it's already militarized already based on what we've already seen.
Well, what Abbott's been doing in terms of measures at the border are just gross human rights violations. The Cortina wire has already led to harm to immigrants trying to cross the Rio Grande. He has taken it upon himself to decide that he's going to enforce immigration law when that clearly resides in the hands of whoever is the president, right? It's a federal administrative authority, and he is defying a Supreme Court order to do this by creating this sort of his own border militia, right? Like what you're talking about with the stationing them in Eagle Pass, creating this facility. This is so incredibly dangerous and also unconstitutional. You know, we have seen basically in the decades since Clinton came into office in the 90s, increasing militarization of the U.S.-Mexico border. You know, Clinton started building the wall. There have been more efforts to put more and more agents along the area, more surveillance around the area. Trump took this way, way too far. The only thing stopping him from actually putting the military on the border, which is what he plans to do if he happens to get into office again, is the fact that there's a law against it in the United States. And, you know, I think the upshot here is that by militarizing the border, you're not solving immigration problems, right? That is not what is going to lead to a safe, fair, and regulated border. I'm not an expert on immigration law, but it's clear that most people think that this is crazy. All it does is make the border area more dangerous for people who are crossing and for people who live there. I mean, one of the things that people don't seem to catch all the time is that when you're spreading hate and bigotry against immigrants, you don't know if somebody is an immigrant or an American citizen or here on some other legal status. And so everybody becomes subject to possible discrimination, hate, and maybe violence. And then, of course, you brought up the issue of actual violence by Border Patrol figures like happened in Del Rio with the whipping of Haitian migrants. This is a whole other issue and a serious issue that has really not fully been addressed. I mean, there have been many articles, and I'm not here to say that this is true of everyone in the Border Patrol, but there have been a lot of articles about Border Patrol agents spreading hate online, being involved in activities related to hate groups. It's a whole other dimension of what this extremism around border issues is leading to. And let me just say, writ large, the fact that Abbott thinks he can militarize the border, put concertina wire, put people's lives at risk, what he's really also saying is that these people aren't humans and they don't belong here. That they're somehow, I don't know, subhuman, subpar individuals. And that's just an absolute moral disgrace.
Attacks on immigrant communities have also extended into the classroom as 2024 saw the Republican-led anti-CRT movement target historically black colleges and universities, or HBCUs, as several GOP-controlled states sought to cut funding or close several HBCUs altogether. But this is neither new nor original. In fact, this latest iteration of anti-history looks similar to Republican attempts to ban ethnic studies in Arizona in the mid-2000s. And so we spoke with both Will Guzman, the Assistant Vice Chancellor of International Programs and Community Engagement at North Carolina Central University in Durham, North Carolina, and Nolan Cabrera, a professor of educational policy studies and practice at the University of Arizona in Tucson, to explain the parallels between GOP attempts to cut HBCU funding with the banning of Latino studies in Arizona in the mid-2000s. And to prove the point, this clip starts with Florida Governor Ron DeSantis' infamous speech attacking African-American studies in his own state.
This course on black history, what's one of the lessons about? Queer theory. Now, who would say that an important part of black history is queer theory? That is somebody pushing an agenda on our kids. And so when you look to see they have stuff about intersectionality, abolishing prisons, that's a political agenda. And so that's the wrong side of the line for Florida standards. We believe in teaching kids facts and how to think, but we don't believe they should have an agenda imposed on them.
So that was Florida Governor Ron DeSantis and a clip of his infamous speech attacking AP African American studies in Florida. So I want to get both of your opinions on this, but I'll start with Professor Guzman. Let's start with the million-dollar question here. Do you see the same parallels between recent attacks on black studies and the ethnic studies ban in Arizona from almost a decade and a half ago?
Most certainly. This type of history, of course, goes back decades and even over a century. And so what we saw in Arizona in attacking Mexican-American studies and labeling it as anti-American, labeling it as Marxist, labeling it as anti-white, it really struck a chord or a nerve for many of the activists, Chicanas and Chicanos there in the state, to mobilize and organize and trying to fight back. Unfortunately, they were not successful to a certain degree. However, they did lay down the groundwork in terms of future fights. And so that mobilization we would see come to a head in terms of other issues that would galvanize many of the activists within the state. What we see in Florida, however, is a more sophisticated version of what went on in Arizona. But at the same time, it was more overt and more coarse. For example, in Florida, as you mentioned at the top of the program, you saw the governor explicitly go after African-American studies, very similar to Arizona. However, within the context of not fearful of the other in terms of immigrants, but fearful of African-Americans who obviously have been in the state well before even Florida even became a state in the 1820s. African-Americans and people of African descent have been in Florida as early as the 1500s. And so you see that the governor refusing to acknowledge and appreciate that history, instead chose to engage in fear-mongering and in order to not only win votes, but win financial support and try to set the stage for a national run at the presidency. Obviously, he lost that fight, but he won in the sense that he was able to galvanize so much support. Even among moderates, if you will, you saw many people come out against this African-American AP course. And if you look at the details of that specific course, which ironically, I too was involved in helping for it to come to the fore, out of the over 100 chapters or sections within that class, only two or three really dealt with transgender issues or feminist issues, all these lightning rod issues that would, you know, fear or strike fear in many people, including conservative African-Americans. And so it was very unfortunate. At the end of the day, we want our children, our teens, and even young adults, we want them to think critically. And those kinds of issues being incorporated into the class would help in that regard in terms of helping people critically think about who they are and what their place is in this society.
Well put. Professor Cabrera, your response. Political did a retrospective back in 2021 on the banning of ethnic studies in the mid-2000s. And one of the things that they pointed out is that Republican lawmakers in Arizona around that time, you know, tried to use the term raza studies sort of in the same fear-mongering nature as the aforementioned Black queer studies that Ron DeSantis mentioned in Florida. So your response.
Absolutely. So it feels almost like I'm kind of in a like a racist version of that Bill Murray movie Groundhog Day, where you know, you just see it keep repeating itself, because literally you can take the playbook that was drawn up in Arizona circa 2010 and take out Arizona, put in any other state that's doing this kind of work, and you have literally the same playbook. Because really what it requires, if we play the Wizard of Oz and pull the curtain back and show how the wizard is there actually manipulating things the whole time, there's a very set playbook. Step one, you need to find something that people don't understand. And so we've already heard little jargon coming around. Raza studies, queer theory, all these different ones. You have to find something that's very, very, and you prey upon the ignorance of the masses. Then step two, you define what that is and you make it very, very harmful. It's like they banned Mexican American studies in Tucson. The first tenet of the bill, it said explicitly, you are not allowed to have classes that promote the overthrow of the U.S. government. Okay. Now, since the country has been founded, sedition is illegal. Like that's not, so that's an unnecessary component of the bill, but it's not a legal issue. It's a discursive issue. It's trying to say Mexican American studies, raza studies is subversive, white hating, American hating, Marxist, all these things, because the kissing cousin of ignorance is fear. And that's what they're trying to play off of. So then there's this willful misdefinition. And then what you do is then you attack. You attack and you say this horrible white-hating, man-hating, American-hating thing, I am the one who can save you from it. And then it wins you political votes frequently. And it's funny because raza studies, that became a lightning rod in there because it was this most simplistic argumentation. It'd say, raza studies. Well, you'd hear the lawmakers say, well, raza means the race, and it's therefore racist. And I always tell my students, if you want to willfully misunderstand something, you use its absolute literal definition in no context. You know, language only means things in context. Like if I said, hey, Oscar, what's up? You're not going to actually look up that literally. It doesn't work like that, right? You know, I'm saying hi. Or if I said, what's up, Holmes? I'm not calling you a house. There are ways that these terms have meaning in context. And the problem is that these folks just don't have a basic grasp of the nature of language. Or maybe they actually have a basic concept of the nature of language and they use it for horrible means, to attack, demean, dehumanize. Because again, you can't be Superman unless you have your Lex Luthor. And they have to create their Lex Luthor in order to be seen as the Superman. And unfortunately, while it is basically a distraction from the fact that they don't have any real legislative agenda, at the end of the day, it still has very negative material effects on our communities in the process. Because as we all know, it takes so much more energy to build something up than it does to tear something down.
While the Latino Media Collective is proudly a show born and bred in Washington, D.C., we cannot overlook our brothers and sisters who listen to us in nearby Baltimore, especially following the tragic collapse of the Francis Scott Key Bridge that left six construction workers dead in late March. So for this segment, we would like to give a shout out to Max Alvarez, the editor-in-chief for the Real News Network in Baltimore, Maryland, and Cloro Longo de Freitas, a community reporter for the Baltimore Banner, for reporting on what corporate media missed in this story. Let's take a listen.
Right, I've seen it too. And I think that all of us who have seen it could see in that one detail from the early morning reporting the day of the Key Bridge collapse, something very different from what, frankly, a lot of our colleagues in the media who apparently don't know a lot of immigrants, they don't even just have to be Latino immigrants, you know, we saw a very different thing, right? Because when I heard that early morning around 1:30 when the dolly crashed into the load-bearing pylon on the Francis Scott Key Bridge and that eight construction workers working for the non-union contractor Bronner Builders who were filling potholes on the bridge in the middle of the night and who were on their lunch break when the bridge itself collapsed, but who themselves did not get a warning about the impending bridge collapse. They did not receive the Mayday call from the dolly. That was a detail that I confirmed when I spoke with Jesus Campos, who also works for Bronner Builders and worked with the men who died on that bridge when I interviewed him by the bridge on the day of the collapse. So on the way there, there's a Royal Farms gas station right next to one of the entrances of the Francis Scott Key Bridge. That's where my colleagues Kayla Rivara and Jocelyn Dombrowski and I were headed as we were, you know, like trying to learn as much as we could about this situation. And I also want to say just credit to Clara, but also like so many of the other incredible journalists in this city for really showing what collaboration looks like and how we can better serve our community when we don't see each other as competitors. Because while we were driving to that site, our former colleague Jessel Knorr, another great journalist in the city, was at home on a Zoom call telling other journalists, including us, like, this is where you should go. This is what I'm seeing online. You know, Claire and I were like lifting each other up, asking like, hey, have you talked to this person? Could you put me in touch with that person? Like, we were all doing our best to try to get the information the community needed. And in that firestorm on the morning of the bridge collapse, I noticed this detail. I believe I first read it in the Baltimore Sun's reporting that when the bridge collapsed and eight men fell into the Patapsco River, six of whom we know died, two of whom were recovered from the water that morning alive. The details were very sparse, but what they said was that one of those men was taken to emergency medical care and one refused emergency care. And I saw white anchors, news anchors in Baltimore repeating this fact and saying like, oh, I guess that guy, the second guy must have just been fine and walked home. And again, like that may have been the case. They may not have known any better. But like, if you know undocumented people, if you know construction workers, if you yourself, as I have worked with a lot of folks in those kinds of situations, people who are uninsured, people who have, you know, like all these reasons to be wary of, you know, the police, to be wary of hospitals, so on and so forth, your mind immediately went to, oh, that person was sin papeles, or they were uninsured, or both, right? And in fact, when I sat down with Latino community organizers that you mentioned for that bilingual podcast that I recorded at the Real News Network, these were incredible folks in the community: Ricardo Ortiz, Susana Barrios, Carlos Crespo, Lucia Islas, along with the co-owners of El Taquito Mexicano in Fells Point. You know, they confirmed, they were like, yeah, like what we know is that that person did not have insurance. And what, just think about that. Anyone out there listening, just think about what that says about our country, to imagine the situation you would have to be in to go through the most traumatic experience in your life, being on a bridge when it collapses and you fall into the water, your colleagues, your coworkers, your friends are dying all around you. You're in the cold waters of the Patapsco River in the middle of the night, and you are so worried about the cost of the medical bills that you refuse a trip to the hospital. Like, if that is not an indictment on the U.S. healthcare system, I don't know what is.
Claire, I want to get your response, and if you saw the same red flags as myself and Max did as the story developed in the initial hours.
Yeah, I think immediately when I saw that there were construction workers and they were the ones who were among the missing, my initial thought immediately went, I'm sure that these are immigrants, I'm sure that these are Latino men. I had the same thought as Max when we heard about the one person who refused medical attention. It seems now that this is someone who might have been a state inspector and that they ran out of the bridge as it was collapsing. It's very unclear, but I had the exact same thought as Max, right? When we hear someone refusing medical attention, we think, is this someone who couldn't afford to pay the bills? Is this someone who is scared that being taken to the hospital would mean somehow, you know, being taken to the authorities and that might cause them to be deported in some way? I think what Max said is true, that these are the questions that journalists like us have when white anchors and white reporters don't, because it's just not on their reality, right? So that's also speaks to the power of having journalists who are part of the communities that we cover, because we will think about this, we will look into things that it won't come immediately onto other people's minds, because that's just not their reality or the reality of the people they love.
Yeah, and even if this person wasn't physically traumatized, I can imagine that they were psychologically traumatized with tons of steel and concrete falling above and below them, and possibly seeing their coworkers and friends dying as all of this is unfolding. You know, those sort of things happen so fast, you know, you will know what to think as it happens. So last year, I was a producer for Latino Rebels Radio, and I had the pleasure of speaking with Rose Godinez, who's an attorney for the Nebraska chapter of the ACLU. This was around the time that we were discussing migrant child labor in the meatpacking industry in that part of the country. In our discussion on migrant child exploitation, she described the meatpacking industry as, quote, rife with retaliation. So to my understanding, that may not necessarily be the case with the company that contracted the workers that perished in the collapse, but it is the case with Maersk, the company that owns the cargo ship that crashed into the bridge, because according to The Lever, the company was recently sanctioned by regulators for blocking its employees from directly reporting safety concerns to the U.S. Coast Guard. So even though both you and Max were able to talk with people in Baltimore's Latino community, did you still confront anyone that was scared to talk to both the press and authorities for fear of retaliation? Max, I know that you mentioned Jesus Campos, and I did see him in certain places being interviewed. And even as he's open to talk, you can hear sort of the tremor and the fear and the trauma in his voice as to what just happened with regards to not only his coworkers, but I would imagine his friends as well.
You know, poor Jesus was clearly very shaken by everything. And, you know, I think that there were a lot of emotions running through him, and I felt some of them myself. And again, the fact that I was able to speak to him in Spanish there when so few people on the ground there were able to do that, you know, I think just like you can hear, like you said, the tremors in his voice. You can pick up on the tones and understand the depth of pain in the words that he's articulating. And yeah, I mean, like, you know, I run into this all the time. I mean, as someone who interviews working people in different industries, different jobs, union, non-union, across the country, across the world, like I do that for a living here at the Real News Network. And it is fundamentally part of what I do to take, you know, as many precautions as I can to try to protect people's jobs, to try to protect their immigration status, their lives, their livelihoods, because so many people in this country are, in fact, at risk when it comes to things like that. I mean, like in, you know, the majority of states around the country, like you can be fired just because your boss doesn't like the look of your face that morning. That's what right to work actually means, right? And to say nothing of, again, just the tremendous amount of unseen workers who keep our economy running, who provide so much of the essential labor that we all depend on, even if we don't value it, whether it's filling our potholes at night, whether it's delivering, you know, like our food orders through gig apps, whether it's, yeah, like, you know, children, like younger than my foster daughter, cleaning bone saws and meatpacking plants, or picking tomatoes under slave conditions for our Wendy's cheeseburgers in Florida, or, you know, children in, like, working in Hyundai parts suppliers in Alabama. Like, I mean, like, cleaning office buildings, domestic workers cleaning houses, right? How many of those people do you actually know? If you do know people in that position, then again, you know the kind of calculations that a working person in that situation has to go through. They could be undocumented, or they could be a returning citizen coming back from prison, right? I mean, they could be someone, you know, like who has had a criminal record and is trying to, you know, get their lives right, but they have to like wade through this horrific tangle of red tape and all these opportunities for them to fall back into the criminal justice system, for them to lose their jobs, lose their homes in a society that criminalizes poverty and homelessness. Like, we live in a really intense meat grinder that so many working people are working their days away in just to try to provide for themselves and their families. But yeah, like so many of the immigrant workers that I talk to, folks who are working under the floorboards of our society, these are the kind of situations they're in. I'll just give one example that came from the podcast that I recorded with the Latino justice organizers here in Baltimore. One thing that they said is, again, while immigrants, especially Latino immigrants, but not exclusively, are being vilified in the media, are being vilified by Donald Trump, who's out there saying that we're poisoning the blood of this country, that we're sucking all of the tax revenue away from like citizens. Like, if you listen to these workers, the people in this community that I spoke to and that Clara is speaking to, that you speak to, you'll hear a very different story. You will hear my foster daughter, Norma Martinez, you know, who herself, you know, has been undocumented from Honduras, has a lot of friends in high school who have to drop out of school and work construction because they can't pay for college. They're not going to get government assistance. Just like Carlos Crespo told me that it was our community, the immigrant community, especially the undocumented community, that was like suffering the most intense effects of COVID because they did not have access to government stimulus checks. They did not have the government support that we had, as inadequate as it was. I mean, it was still life-saving. And for people who didn't have that, they were going into work without proper PPE, without sick pay, without these protections. A lot of people died. A lot of people got sick, have long COVID. Like, this is just one of many, many examples of how immigrant workers and people who are working in the shadows of our economy are hyper-exploited. And yet they are the ones who are being targeted as the vilified out-group in this country.
You're listening to the Latino Media Collective Year in Review 2024, looking back on some of the important domestic stories covered on the show. And you're listening to WPFW 89.3 FM Washington. Back with more in a minute. Stay tuned. You're listening to the Latino Media Collective Year in Review 2024. And for the next segment, going back to the anti-immigrant sentiment in the country in 2024, the Haitian diaspora saw some of the most vile stereotypes thrusted upon them from almost everyone in the Republican Party. Some of these stereotypes became so normalized in the political landscape that even both Donald Trump and then vice presidential candidate J.D. Vance repeated them in corporate media. Even Vance himself admitted that what he said wasn't true. And all this happened in corporate media with little to no Haitian voices to fight back. Which is why we invited François-Pierre Louis, a professor of political science at Queens College City University of New York, for a more nuanced discussion on American hatred towards Haiti.
Yo, listeners, will forgive me if I start with a little brief history of the attack on Haitians and Haiti in general. As you know, Haiti got its independence in 1804. The only slave society that successfully fought white supremacists, especially the French, and with the success of the Haitian Revolution, that was a demise of the slavery system, in the sense that the Haitians proved to the world that this idea that they were having free races is a myth, and that black people were as intelligent, strong, and warriors as anybody else, and they were able to defeat the world's largest and most powerful army in 1804. As a result of that, the white supremacists never forgave Haitians and Haiti for undermining their whole system of exploitation and their whole system of how they had organized the world. As soon as the revolution was over, there was this whole narrative about Haiti, how horrible the people are. There were savages because they were killing the white men. Many of the occupiers had to flee Haiti. Some of them landed in Louisiana. Others went to Maryland. They went to the part of the United States, and they continued that narrative. Jefferson, U.S. president at that time, wrote that the U.S. should never establish diplomatic relations with Haiti, because that would prove the case that black people can achieve success and undermine the whole slavery system they have. As a result of that narrative, whenever the American government and American society had a chance to attack Haiti, they always did. And it's always in a way to show that Haitians are unable to take care of themselves. And in general, by that, showing that black people, people of color, are unable to take care of themselves. So during all that time that Haiti became independent, not only the U.S. did not establish diplomatic relations, recognize Haiti until after the Civil War in 1863, but also the narrative that Haitians are unable to take care of themselves was solidified with the U.S. occupation of Haiti in 1917, and they only got out of Haiti in 1934. And again, there were several other occupations, and the U.S. kept getting into Haitians' business, internal affairs. They occupied its economy. They restructured the army so that the army can be an occupying force for the American elite and the Haitian elite wanted to establish their own businesses in Haiti. So therefore, when the idea that Haitians could not fight for themselves became the narrative for the world, because they control the media and they control the other parts of the world, such as the economy, the trade, the technology, many people had grown up with the idea that Haitians are unable to do anything. But they cannot admit that Haitians were the first to really live to the true meaning of all people are equal, regardless of race, gender, national origin. Because Haitians, the first constitution that Haitians created, it gave citizenship to anyone being persecuted, no matter where in the world. Whether you were slaves, former slaves, you were people being persecuted, you came to Haiti and you were given freedom. The Polish army who came, some of the Polish who came to fight with the Napoleon's army, when they got to Haiti, they realized what the Haitians were doing. They turned around and began to support the Haitians. As a result of that, Dessalines was one of the emperors who liberated Haiti, created two communities in Haiti that were given land. The Poles were given land, they were given territory, and they were treated as citizens, and their descendants are still living in those towns in Haiti, one in the south, one in the north. So therefore, Haiti has always been the beacon of liberty and freedom since its independence. But, you know, when you attack an enemy like we did regarding white supremacy, then the whole white supremacy structure, whether it is in the United States, whether it is in Europe, cannot admit that the Haitians are one and liberated themselves and freed the empire from the exploitation that was taking place human exploitation. So that's why this whole narrative still exists, and Haitians have been resilient, have resisted it, have fought it in various ways. For example, during the American occupation, you had guerrillas that were formed to fight against the occupation because they did not like the Marines coming into Haiti. In other places, they organized, they mobilized, they created infrastructure to always resist. And the attack on Haitians, really, is the fact that they're trying to build the culture. They're trying to change your history. They're trying to forget Haiti as what it was, what it is today. Because once you've forgotten your history, once you have a different narrative, then they can get rid of you. They have done that with other civilizations. They have done that with other ethnic groups. So Haiti, I wouldn't be surprised that that's their intention, especially these days when we see that Florida, they want to talk about slavery as it was a terrible system.
Yeah.
And now in Florida, they're removing social studies as a core curriculum in the core curriculum in the schools and the colleges. And secondly, all over, they're trying to rewrite history so that they don't take the blame for putting the world in this chaotic situation that we are living in today.
Thank you for that nuanced analysis of Haitian history, especially under the magnifying glass of U.S. imperialism, as you mentioned, because over the years, we've done several shows here highlighting all sorts of Haitian politics or Haitian moments in history. And we've also had numerous Haitian guests during the course of those years. And almost every single one, independent of one another, have mentioned almost the same thing that you've mentioned, which is that this U.S. perception of Haitians unable to take care of themselves, you know, has little to do with this perception of bad democratic genes, but everything to do with U.S. imperialism. And it could be easily be applied to any other country in the Western Hemisphere as well. This perception is as old as Haitian independence itself. And we should also point out that we could also make this criticism of the United States and apply it to France as well, and perhaps to a lesser degree, Canada over the years. Now, I want to go to the issue of recent events, particularly the election cycle, because while Trump's rhetoric towards all immigrants certainly give us cause for concern, to a certain degree, some of what he has proposed is neither new nor original when it comes to the U.S. treatment of Haitian refugees over the years. You sort of alluded to that already. So, for example, can you tell us about the U.S. treatment of Haitian refugees in places like South Florida, which you just mentioned, back in the 1970s and even during the Reagan administration in the 80s, that eventually led to the development of Guantanamo Bay in Cuba,
yes,
as a detention camp?
When the Haitians were fleeing the repressive Duvalier regime in the 1970s and 80s, the American government was giving asylum to people fleeing the Soviet Union, people fleeing the Castro regime. All of them were presenting the same cases that Haitians, you know, Bovary. For example, you have an authoritarian regime. You have been persecuted because of your political viewpoint. You are seeking asylum because that's part of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, that you have the right to seek asylum in another country if you have been persecuted and your life is in danger in your home country. So the Haitians were given a separate treatment compared to everybody else who were fleeing their oppressive regime in their own country. Whereas the Cubans or the people from the former Soviet Union were automatically given asylum, given support, financial aid, and help them reorganize themselves in the U.S. Haitians, they were put in jail, imprisoned in camps in Puerto Rico, at Coom, at the detention center in South Florida. And the whole strategy was to prevent them from coming to the U.S. and intimidate them so that they can be sent back to Haiti under the brutal Duvalier regime. Again, why was Haitian given a separate treatment, different treatment than the others? First, because of Haiti's history. Secondly, because they were black. This is true. They did not want any black people going into South Florida, other parts of the United States, because we know how racism exists in the United States, and racism is still very strong. Secondly, the U.S. government was supporting the authoritarian regime, the dictatorship, in Haiti. So therefore, if they were accepting the Haitians here, that would undermine all the logic of supporting a dictator in Haiti. And third, knowing full well the history of Haitians, their resiliency, the capacity of them to organize themselves and show what they can prove. So it was always a question of using Haitians as a lesson to any other country in the world who would define us. If we treat Haitians so badly because they define us, other countries might not want to do the same thing because they don't want to be like Haitians. In fact, when in Guadeloupe and Martinique, when they were fighting for their own independence against the French, one of the arguments the French government used to tell them, the revolutionaries in Martinique, the progressive groups in Martinique and Guadeloupe, you guys want to be like Haiti. If you fight us, we're going to make sure we crush you. We're going to make sure that your society doesn't exist, doesn't improve, doesn't provide for its own population. And you will always be the ones that everyone would be treated badly. So this is why they kept Haitians in jail, at home, at the Brooklyn Navy Yard, in Puerto Rico, and eventually in Guantanamo. Because that was a systematic way of preventing Haitians from assuming their full freedom and enjoying their human rights.
And we close this best of episode with Lorena Quiroz, the founder and director of the Immigrant Alliance for Justice and Equity based in Mississippi, who minces no words to the impact of the 2019 ICE raids that took place in Mississippi and how it still affects the state Latino community 5 years later.
Well, we need to go back to 2019 with regards to the ICE raids in Mississippi, which 5 years later still remains the largest immigration raid in the country, almost 5 years later. There have been several other raids that have taken place in Mississippi since then, but this was particularly problematic in a number of ways. The event was also infamous, Lorena, for images of children crying on the streets, for their parents, and left with few relatives to take care of them afterwards. There have been other raids, like I said before, in Mississippi since, but looking back in retrospect, how much did this affect the Latino community in Mississippi, especially the children involved?
I have papers and I traveled with my passport when that happened. The fear was immediate. It affected the neighbors because they ended up having to take care of children of their loved ones for some 4 months at a time. It affected the people in the church. It affected central Mississippi, and then it affected the entire state. I had people call me from 3 hours away asking questions about ICE sightings of the black SUVs with tinted windows all over the state, and that fear stayed with our people. The people that were directly impacted by the raids, when they tell you their stories, they will start crying. It affects them physically and emotionally to this day. And I've spoken to people that can't drive by the sight because they immediately remember the helicopters buzzing over. And there's countless stories, people that called in sick because they had to take their child, they missed a vaccine, so they had to go to the health department. And so their wife was taken in and they weren't. Their stories of, parents lying, saying that they were single parents because they let some of the single parents go. There's so many things that it did to the community and the neighbors because people were loved. But then you also have that cognitive dissonance that occurs in red states, in Republican spaces, or in anti-immigrant spaces where people have lived side by side, benefited from workers, and yet they still will claim, well, these people deserve it.
Mm.
And so when I saw that happen before my eyes, and you mentioning the institutional, right, the lack of care, the how they band together to protect themselves and, you know, in that way also bring harm to the affected community. I saw that happening because I was the organizer on the ground. It was crazy. I can quote you community leaders who owned, they were like, of course, they bring us all as Mexicans. These Mexicans, I love these Mexicans, but, you know, they're the ones who make me my business, but they deserved it. So that's the kind of rhetoric that you would hear. And we had friends, we had people from China interview us. We had the entire world looking at Mississippi. And when they would hear these things, they just couldn't believe the disdain, you know. And again, it was that rhetoric that the administration before this one was constantly putting out on social media, on TV, you know, the image that they deserved what they got. During the death of Duvan, on our way to Hattiesburg, our organizer was listening to a radio, and he called me immediately. He said, listen to this. And you had conservative talk show hosts talking about how, well, if they would, they blamed the death of Duvan on the border being open. And what they said was, if these borders were secure, okay, this is the logic. If the borders were secure, that these people would not be here and this child would not have happened. This death would not have happened. So basically, they were putting the blame on the vulnerable child, on the exploited worker, on the exploited families.
On the victim.
And so on the victim, and so you see that happening. And the New York Times wrote an article that I'm not too happy about, where they try to highlight or try to pitch Black and brown people against each other. And that wasn't happening. Black churches showered money and gifts, as well as white churches. They brought in donations. Some people were able to pay for their rent for months, utilities. For months, because their loved ones were detained. And so, you know, it's crazy what media can do sometime, and how, you know, people want to shape the way of what things were happening. That wasn't happening. What did happen is those images of that child, and we can all pretty much, as I'm talking, can see that little girl crying, why my parents, right? What did happen was that the churches and the schools took care of the children. Families came in, the coalitions came in and tried to create, you know, paperwork so that people would be able to take care of children and make sure that it was all done legally. But the pain that these children and the trauma has not been addressed. Because if you think about it, when you talk about the rates, you talk about the 680 workers and then the 100 workers that were let go immediately afterwards. Who's talking about the children? Who's talking about what was going on in their minds? Going back to school, one of our teenagers that was working with us actually got written up and got sent to whatever they call after school because he was acting up, and he took an entire week because his mom was detained. And so for people to not understand the pain, the trauma, that they expected children to go on as if nothing, it's horrendous. And another example of how little they think about us as human beings, we did have some folks that I like to say parachuted in, you know, like folks from other states that love to do work here and get PhDs here and write books about us and very easily can leave. I'm being a little shady here, but it's very easy.
Go ahead.
Living in Mississippi is hard. And the people live here and they love here and they work here. So for you to come in, do a little work and then become an expert on us, I don't appreciate that. If you want to do that, then you should continue to work to support families. You should be checking on us. You should be providing resources, all the things that you gained by the work that you did here on the shoulders of workers.
This has been the best of 2024 on the Latino Media Collective. We hope you enjoy this segment. We're going to have part three next week. In the meantime, we hope everyone has a safe holiday and a safe new year. And we'll see you all in 2025. Adios. Nos vemos. Ciao.
Miyuki, Interim General Manager. As we close out this incredible 2024, we want to take a moment to thank you. Your support, passion, and belief in WPFW's mission have made 2024 possible. You sustained WPFW, you helped fortify WPFW from malicious unknowns, and you ensured WPFW could transition to a new studio where broadcasting has been uninterrupted. Together, we've celebrated the music and the stories. Together, we've presented the voices often unheard and have provided much-needed insights. Here's to you, our listeners, volunteers, and supporters for making this all possible. Thank you from all of us, WPFW. Together, we will build a better world, one broadcast at a time.
Greetings. WPFW is pleased to announce the relaunch of our major donor program, now known as the Jazz and Justice Circle.